From India's largest newsroom, I'm Arun George, and this is the Times of India podcast.
कोई भी टेररिस्ट हमारे पड़ोसी देश से भारत को डिस्टर्ब करने की कोशिश करेगा, यहाँ पर जी आतंकवादी हरकतें करेगा, तो उसका मुंह तोड़ जवाब देंगे। यदि वो भगकर पाकिस्तान में जाएगा तो पाकिस्तान में घुस कर मारेंगे।
The Indian government may have rejected all allegations of carrying out a killing in Canada and attempting one in the US. No government official has ever commented on the killings of multiple terror-linked persons in Pakistan. So it came as a bit of a surprise when Defence Minister Rajnath Singh, who is on the campaign trail for the upcoming national elections presently, said that India would definitely strike back at those who provoked the country with acts of terror. Today's episode is a rerun of an episode we'd done some months back about the claims that India had been carrying out covert strikes on people abroad. In the case of the allegations from the US and Canada, the targets were individuals from Khalistan-linked groups. We'd spoken with Rory Cormack, who is a professor of international relations at the University of Nottingham. Professor Cormack specializes in the study of covert action and secret statecraft and is the author of the book titled How to Stage a Coup and 10 Other Lessons from the World of Secret Statecraft. We'd also spoken with Ajay Sahni, who is the executive director of the Institute for Conflict Management in New Delhi. We'd asked both of them what it meant for India to be accused of carrying out covert strikes in other countries and the possible fallout.
Were you surprised at all when the two accusations came, first by Canada and the US regarding India?
I was and I wasn't. So I wasn't surprised so much because states engage in this kind of thing. And one thing that I know from my own research is that lots of states do this. And lots of states have done this since the beginning of statecraft. This is part of international politics. Maybe this is the more acute end, but secret statecraft and covert operations is something that lots and lots of states do. But I was surprised, and this goes to the point about India's reputation, insofar as an outsider, I don't know about the local politics. This, I think, shone a light for outsiders who don't follow India particularly closely, and we realize this whole thing is going on. Maybe I'm just particularly ignorant on this, but it shone a light on another part of Indian foreign policy and domestic and security policy, which I didn't know about.
What reputation does India enjoy in the West when it comes to these kind of secret operations? Because India itself typically presents itself as a nation that doesn't carry out such operations. But how is India viewed abroad?
The honest answer is doesn't have a particular reputation for doing this kind of thing. It's not really talked about. We think a lot about Russia dominating the headlines around here, around these issues. We know that the Americans dominate headlines as well when it comes to the history of this kind of activity. Whereas in comparison, we know that India has a reputation for a cautious approach to covert operations in the decades post-independence. And I think it's also fair to say that the reputation is growing for embracing secret statecraft a bit over the last 10 years. But the general impression as an outsider was that this is generally consigned to local issues, to cross-border issues, rather than doing something literally on the other side of the world.
In terms of the methodology that was used, in both cases, we have accusations of the Indian state working with organized crime gangs to execute these operations. Is that a common thing across such operations?
I think this is a really important point. When allegations are made about government involvement in any kind of covert action or killing or whatever it may be, is that there's a whole spectrum. So on the one hand, it can be the government using their own special forces, going in directly or drones and killing a target. On the other end, it can be a government turning a blind eye to criminal activity or mafia or assassins or drug gangs and just letting them get away with it. And then obviously there's a whole range of different levels of complicity in between. And that's obviously also going to impact the response if the state has preached American sovereignty with its special forces teams to go and try and kill somebody. That is a very different and more serious accusation. And that's not been made, but that would be a much more serious accusation than saying that organized crime did what they thought the Indian government wanted to do. The Indian government turned a blind eye, didn't round them up. So they're two very different accusations, very different levels of severity. And I think the kind of the reputation costs and the potential punishments or outcomes would obviously be more significant if the state has a more direct link. I think it also ties in with plausibility of the denials. I mean, when states weigh up doing this, if they are taking an active role, they need to calibrate. How obvious is our involvement going to be? Is it going to be a case where we can plausibly deny this and there's enough ambiguity that we can get away with it? Or are the denials going to be frankly implausible, which changes the calculations a bit, changes the rationale? When states are trying to work out the reputational costs against the potential benefits, they're thinking about some of these issues.
Ajay Sani is the executive director of the Institute of Conflict Management, and he's the editor of the South Asia Intelligence Review. A close watcher of Khalistani groups in India and abroad, Ajay Sani tells us that one problem with the accusations from both the US and Canada is that there's very little proof accompanying them.
First of all, let me make it very clear, we have no inside information on this. So we don't know whether this has actually been done or not. Even if you see the Canadian statement and the discourse in Canada, the opposition parties in Canada and others, even members of Trudeau's Liberal Party, have made it very clear that no evidence was shared with them when this claim was made in Parliament.
Canadian security agencies have been actively pursuing credible allegations of a potential link between agents of the government of India and the killing of a Canadian citizen, Hardeep Singh Nijjar.
So apart from the claim that they have evidence, which India has rejected, we do not know of any evidence as such.
Ajay Sani also points out that given all those killed are presumed to have links with organized criminal gangs and terrorist groups, there are multiple reasons why they may have ended up dead.
Since we see no evidence at all from either Canada or from the US, one must treat these things as we treat political claims, not as claims of a crime committed, and politicians essentially are professional liars. So I give no credence, nor do I dismiss. I have no position to dismiss this. Very credible alternatives to the thesis being proposed exist. These are individuals who are involved in extremely controversial activities, often in crimes, linked to terrorist organizations, linked to criminal organizations. They have all sorts of, shall we say, internal conflicts. They have rivalries. In the case of Nijjar, we saw very clearly that these rivalries existed. One of his rivals was killed a year ago, after Nijjar had threatened him. So please investigate the Indian role. I have no problems with that. Multiple alternatives exist as to who could have done it. Gather the evidence and then please put it out. Please take the Indian state to the cleaners. I have no problems with that. I'd be quite happy if such activities were completely exposed, because this is not the kind of India we want.
Mr. Sani, if it were to be proved that India had a role, would it surprise you that we are capable of such covert operations?
First of all, understand this was not what you would call a covert operation in the sense that an agent was sent out to target this individual. Most likely, all these individuals, in case we take the American allegation seriously, most such cases would have been done through a criminal proxy, a local gang. This is not quite as easy as it may sound. I mean, you can't just walk into a country, either in America or Canada, and look up the yellow pages and find someone to bump off your target. But it is not a operation that would be very difficult to arrange over time for a agency.
You mentioned Pakistan. There have been three alleged attacks on organizations like LET, JEM, Hizbul. What do you make of those?
You cannot speak of these with any kind of authority. I don't speak of what I don't know. I have no way to document whether these are done by us. All these people are, involved in extremely murky activities. These are terrorists. These are people who are supported by a particular state, and that state has in the past pulled out its support from certain individuals whose loyalty they begin to suspect. Those people simply die. Who we choose to attribute these actions to depends purely on your ideological position or your political affiliation. If you are pro the BJP, you will say, oh, we did all this. If you are anti the BJP, you will say, we did none of this. If you want to take an objective position, you have to come out with this simple and frank statement, I don't know. I don't know. I have no idea whether they've done it or not.
Analysts say that much like domestic politics, India, as far as foreign policy is concerned, has adopted a very aggressive stance in the last 8 to 10 years. Do you see a trend emerging at all?
Well, first of all, I'd like to see say the which aggressors. I don't think we take the same position to the Chinese. So let's be very clear. We are choosing our adversaries selectively. And in terms of an ideological position, which feeds into domestic politics and allows us to present the people who hold power present in a particular light to their own electoral constituency. Look at the actions actually taken, apart from this allegation of bumping people off in other countries. Almost everything that has been done has been either a continuation of what was being done in the past in counterterrorism or was a theatrical demonstrative act with little or no impact on the ground. I'm talking Balakot, surgical strikes. Surgical strikes have never been tom-tommed the way they were tom-tommed when this dispensation did it. The Balakot strike is widely accepted as having had little or no impact. So I don't see this government as having done anything extraordinary beyond what was already being done. And where they have done something out of the way, it has been more for theatrical impact rather than in terms of substantive impact on the adversary.
So we know for sure that we don't know if India is behind these murders in Canada and Pakistan and the one murder plot in the US. But what does it mean for a country to be accused of such crimes? We asked Professor Rory Cormack about the cost of being accused of such crimes.
I think the fact that it's now two accusations does give a bit more weight to it and starts to indicate a potential pattern of behaviour, which makes the impact more substantial. I think it'll give a reputation that India is becoming more muscular on the global stage, for better or worse. It's not afraid, I mean, if this is true, to do this kind of thing. But and ultimately, I think India will get away with it, for want of a better phrase, again, if they're involved, and will ride out some of these allegations. You mentioned Russia, Saudi Arabia killing Khashoggi a few years back. Everyone was very outraged. There were costs. But ultimately, the economic sad reality of the world, I suppose, in some ways, the economic importance of these relationships between big players often means that while states might be very angry for a bit, they ultimately get away with it.
That Indian agencies have been accused of these crimes, despite an absence of hard evidence in the public domain, would raise questions about the efficiency of such covert operations. Given Rory Cormack has studied such events over the decades and involving multiple nations, we asked him about the pitfalls of such covert operations.
When states do, conduct such covert operations, are they also likely to backfire sometimes?
Yes, they can do. There's two levels of backfiring. The first one is they go wrong and they don't work and the person survives and it's embarrassing and you get all the reputational costs without actually eliminating the target. But then even if a state does succeed in killing a particular target, I mean, the evidence that then creates a better security outcome is mixed at best, because you can create vacuums and new people can step in and take that person's place, and the new people might be even more angry or violent, can radicalize wider communities. But when that's true of targeted killings, it's also true of coups and electoral interference and all these kind of things. You might get a short-term gain for the state, but in the long term, the same constraints are there that caused the problematic person to be problematic, and the new person might well end up being worse than the old person. You might get a short-term win if successful in the, you know, in the actual operation, but there's no guarantee that that's going to lead to better security outcomes long-term.
Is there a case of a state indulging in this sort of statecraft and paying a price domestically for it in any sense? Or is it sort of raise their stature even more?
It can almost send a message to domestic audiences. There's no proof, but there's a lot of, as we were saying, implausible deniability. People know that this has happened. That can actually send a message to domestic audiences. It can make the leader look tough. It can make the leader look like he or she is willing to stand up for, you know, his or her country's interests and take tough decisions and all this kind of stuff. So there's a weird paradox going on. Even though this kind of statecraft is supposedly covert and secret, a lot of it is quasi-secret and nudge, nudge, wink, wink, which actually sends messages to domestic audiences, but also to international audiences. Messages can be stop harboring people that we don't like, stop harboring dissidents, take these things more seriously. That's a message potentially that's gone out elsewhere. And I was reading people from the same community in the UK worrying about their safety. So there's a clear, regardless of the truth of what happened, there's a clear message now reverberating beyond the immediate cases.
Ajay Sahni says it doesn't even matter if the allegations are ever proved or backed with hard evidence, because in spite of the denials, it is likely to yield domestic gains for the Narendra Modi government.
There is, of course, the projection, the pattern of advertising that is taking place, which is very different. And that has had an impact on domestic politics more than anything else. I don't think anybody outside is impressed by this. And if at all these incidents have been actually executed by Indian agencies, the sheer clumsiness of having been caught out put us on a very, very weak footing internationally. Domestically, it's worked very well. I will still retain that whatever happens in this case, because those who are what they call the bhakts, the people who are supportive of this regime and this ideology, they are already celebrating that, yes, we did it. If you go through the social media, you see that they are now attributing a whole lot of deaths in Pakistan, in the UK, wherever anybody dies now, RNAW did it, as far as the partisan groupings are concerned. So domestically, it's worked very well for them. Internationally, it has worked in some measure adversely. The allegations have worked a little adversely. But again, I think not with any serious impact.
If India were to, a few months on, say, attribute its claim over these operations or goes ahead and conducts a major one, how do you see it playing out both domestically and internationally?
I would like to suggest that I don't think we'll see too many of these actions in the foreseeable future, because the response to these allegations has already been so adverse internationally. Domestically, I think what they will do is continue to allow others to make the claim. Allow proxies to make the claim. Let it go out in the social media. Let it go out at a level of deniability where the state is saying nothing. Advantage of secret agencies and their actions is that they don't ever come out and say yes or no. They're not going to make a claim. They're not going to deny a claim. Now, the absence of a denial in this context for the people who want affirmation becomes an affirmation. And that's what we will see playing out within the electoral discourse. There will be a lot of implicit signaling that, look, this is all being done by us. We are now a different kind of power. Etc., etc. But none of this is ever going to come out of the mouth of a state agent or a representative of the Indian state.
But shouldn't India be allowed to go after its adversaries? Even if not with brawny commandos who do martial arts, surely terrorism everywhere deserves the same response. If the US can send strike teams and have drone strikes, why should such a big deal be made of a targeted Indian strike against a secessionist or a terrorist. We asked Rory Cormack about this argument.
One thing that's happened with the US allegations is a lot of Indian commentators have bristled at both the US and the Canadian allegations, saying that it smacks of double standards, that if the US can go after people outside their borders, why can't India go after wanted terror suspects in this manner in Western nations? How do you view that?
It's a really interesting one. And I think that whatever the rights and wrongs of the American targeted killing program, which we've seen a lot of since 9/11, including the killing of Qasem Soleimani in Iran a couple of years ago, whatever the rights and wrongs of that, it has eroded the taboo, I think, around killing, around extrajudicial killing. And I think the more that Western states engage in this activity, the more that Western states kill people, to put it bluntly, the more other states are able to deploy the whataboutism arguments, however unfairly or fairly, when they get criticized for doing something similar.
But Ajay Sani says that despite the projection of power within India in terms of targeting its enemies abroad, India can't hope to change its own image among other nations.
You know, international perceptions over time tend to even out, to come into some kind of balance with your actual capacity and power. You can't bluff your way through for a very long time. The adversary knows what you are really capable of. They are making continuous assessments of what you are saying and what you could do and what you are actually doing. Even if a couple of guys are bumped off on foreign soil, it doesn't change India's status or India's capacities and capabilities in terms of actual counterterrorism or actual capacity to deal with the adversary on foreign soil.
Today's episode was produced by Jairaj Singh and Anuja Singh. For a daily spotlight on people, ideas and stories that matter, subscribe to us. We're available on TOI Plus, Spotify, Apple, Google Podcasts, and all other platforms of your choice. For any news tips, email us at toipodcast@timesinternet.in.